now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning layer ones to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side. Before we jump in, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible. Kava is a cross-chain DeFi platform that gives you the ability to earn more by connecting the world's largest cryptocurrencies, ecosystems, and financial applications in one safe and seamless integration. We're excited for the upcoming launch of the Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Swap will join the Kava Protocol and Hart Protocol as the next application built on the Kava platform. Celo is a mobile-first platform that makes financial dApps and crypto payments accessible to anyone with a mobile phone, providing the opportunity to positively impact the users of 6 billion smartphones in circulation today. Celo's eco-friendly proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and ultra-mobile light client makes up to 17,000 times faster than other blockchains and accessible to mobile phone users around the world. Visit Celo.org to learn more. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Tom Shaughnessy. I help run Delphi Ventures, and I co-host the pod. Today, I'm super amped to have Eric, also known as Snowfro, the founder of Artblocks. Eric, how's it going?
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm super happy to be here.
Yeah, man. Artblocks is known everywhere. You guys are really changing the space. I'm excited to have you. Let's start off with a little bit of how you got started in crypto.
Yeah, I got started in 2017. Actually, New Year's Eve 2016, I had this burning desire to own a whole Bitcoin by the beginning of 2017. That quickly led me to discover Ethereum, because on Coinbase, there was two things, Bitcoin and what seemed like a cheap knockoff of Bitcoin, Ethereum, because it's like, well, one's hundreds of dollars and one was seven. And so at first I ignored it, and then I was like, okay, well, I should learn more. There's a reason why it's on here. And discovered the concept of a smart contract, and I just, like, Bitcoin blew my mind, no question. And then smart contracts blew my mind. Like, the idea that you could assign instructions to money, it just, man. So one of the first things I did, which was kind of experimental, I guess, is I created a smart contract and deposited 10 ETH into it. And my best friend had a baby. And so I basically said, okay, I'm going to deposit 10 ETH into the smart contract and she can't touch it until she's 18. And so
college is paid for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see, right? Cause we still have a long time to go, but like you set time in seconds. So it was like 600 million seconds or something like that. And so the smart contract basically says that on the kid's 18th birthday, at the moment that she turns 18, like to the second, she'll be able to unlock 10 ETH. And it sounds super reckless now, but it was less than $100 worth of ETH at the time. I thought ETH was going to be worth a lot of money. I didn't think it would be worth $3,000 to $4,000 this quickly, though. I mean, I didn't. But I had also only just gotten started in the crypto space. You know, if I did, I think at one point I did have like 1,000 ETH, right? Like when ETH is $7. You know, I probably would have just held on to that ETH instead of spending it on, you know, all the different things that the DApp websites were showing as like proof of concepts for crypto at the time. But yeah, I mean, I got really excited. I still look back at that proof of concept as something that blows my mind. The fact that this money is there, I'd love to start like a little website where people could do this for their kids or their friends' kids. Obviously, it just feels very different to be able to give someone 0.001 ETH or 0.01 ETH now for $100, but it felt more substantial back then. One of the many things that I blew my ETH on was claiming CryptoPunks in 2017. You know, was browsing Reddit, saw a post, got really excited about it, jumped over to the Larva Labs website, realized that my Ethereum wallet was not synced, because back then there was no MetaMask. You know, there was my crypto wallet, but I was going to put a private key into my crypto wallet. I just didn't, you know, it's like I'd already been scammed a couple of times by this point. And yeah, I claimed a bunch of CryptoPunks. That further blew my mind, you know, provable ownership of a digital asset. Holy moly, like smart money, smart assets, like time locks. It just, yeah, my brain exploded. And so here we are today, 4 years later, you know, kind of had one overarching desire, especially during 2017, kind of watching all the like altcoin stuff. And that was to create a use case for crypto that was compelling to the outside world, really not perpetuating the square peg round hole that you just saw so much of. Not because people are malicious, just because they were just excited and nerded out on crypto like I was. Like, we were all looking for really cool things to do with crypto. And but I saw enough of them that I was just like, okay, well, I want to do something with crypto and I want it to be really big, but I really, really will have this one rule. And it's that it does not present any opportunity for someone to say, well, you could also do this without a blockchain. And it's tough to find these use cases, right? So yeah, 4 years later, launched Artbox. It's a hobby.
Eric, it's got to be annoying though for people on Twitter to say like, oh, these CryptoPunks guys got lucky. I mean, you literally blew a good chunk of your stack 4 years ago. Like 4 years is a world ago in crypto.
Yeah, I mean, it was $35 worth of ETH to claim. And at that point, I'm a huge generative art nerd, right? So like I question, if they would not have been generative, would I have claimed? I don't know, because I actually saw them as really cool works of art. As a generative art project, the Larva Labs guys are brilliant. Like, they're able to pack character and like emotion into this 24 by 24 pixel image and pack it into 10,000 unique 24 by 24 pixel images. Like, I was blown away by that and blown away by the ownership potential. And but yeah, I still claimed all of them and I was like, man, I just blew $35. Like, it still felt weird because gas was not cheap. I mean, it sounds really cheap now because one mint is $35, but back then it was a lot. And yeah, I don't resent the early comments, you know, the comments about people that were there early. I mean, it depends on what point you are in your life, but like, you know, my whole life I've noticed that some people were there before others, and kind of it does feel like some of them got lucky. But also, if you look at the people that held on to their punks this long, it really requires an insane amount of conviction, especially in 2017, where nobody could have even guessed that it was going to get this crazy, to have kept those punks. So cheers to those people that not just bought them, but even in 2020, when you could sell a CryptoPunk for $2,000-$3,000, saying, nope, I'm sticking to this.
Well, no, I mean, it's a really good point because, I mean, everyone always, you know, I laugh when I see people on Twitter and they're like, oh, you know, too many OpenSea notifications. Let me raise my, you know, ETH threshold, you know, to 1-5 ETH so it doesn't get hit. But on the flip side, like, if your NFTs are hitting that and you sell, to your point, you lose the entire opportunity to hold something that could be extremely valuable.
And if you believe that this is the beginning of a new revolution in digital ownership, and in particular with generative projects, like a new revolution in individuality and being able to have like a shard of something bigger for an oftentimes affordable price. I mean, CryptoPunks were free. CryptoKitties were, you know, 0.01 ETH or however much. I mean, but you know, those things made individuality affordable. And anybody that was kind of early on that kind of felt that same bug, that same kind of like intense validation, just is holding on. And of course, sometimes there's offers that it's really hard to say no to. You know, it gets harder the more punks you sell, it gets harder to sell them. And obviously, like, you know, we all want to have our babies. But, it also feels nice when they get to go to new hands and new people. The number of holders of punks has increased from, I think it was like mid 900s last year to like 2,500 accounts plus. And that's pretty special considering there's only 10,000 and many of us have multiple punks. So you have a 2,500 people in this world that get to kind of have this proof of individuality that didn't really exist before. And I think that there's something really special there.
No, I agree. I have a lot of questions for you on this. I'm sure everyone's up to speed on NFTs and generative art, given this third episode in the series. But why was there such a gap between the generative art of 2017 and now generative art popping off? Like, why did it take 4 years to be like extremely important, I guess? And I'm obviously missing a lot of the history that you went through, but what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I think there was a big gap in everything in 2019, right? Like between 2017 and 2021. In 2019, a lot of us nerded out at NFT.NYC for the first time, like meeting each other after being on Discord for a really long time and just nerding out about these 24 pixel characters. And I left there with this crazy extra vigor towards the space. Like, I don't know what I was going to expect. I don't know if I just thought I was going to be talking to a bunch of turtles or something. Like, I just really felt when I left there, I was like, man, I just talked to a lot of humans, and those humans are great. And I think that this space is going to explode. So, you know, I wouldn't say that things were non-existent during that time, but you know, there's a lot that didn't happen during that time. There wasn't like these huge ups and downs and like hype cycles that we're seeing right now. What did happen was the release of autoglyphs, the ability for CryptoPunks to start gaining a bigger audience. And I personally, during that time, came home and took some money out of savings to buy a bunch of autoglyphs and CryptoPunks, because I was like, man, like, people really don't understand what they're missing out on here. Like, the people that were dumping autoglyphs for $50, granted, or $500, whatever, they made a bunch of money, so great, that's fine. But it just seemed like it was short-lived. Like, the long-term vision of this, I felt, was going to be really important. So I think there just wasn't a lot during that time. There was a lot of firsts, and those firsts proved interesting and viable. And so maybe it took a lot of those firsts also to kind of inspire people like me to finally pull the trigger. I started developing ArtBlox as a concept the moment I was claiming my CryptoPunks. And I started developing it as a platform the beginning of 2018 on Ethereum. At the end of 2017, I was developing it as a platform where I was going to start my own cryptocurrency called ArtBlox and Masternodes, if you remember Masternodes in 2017.
Oh, yeah. Way back.
A art project was going to be equivalent of a masternode. And that was going to kind of control these artworks and like the outputs of these artworks. A really weird concept that we actually will probably go back to in ArtBlox, not masternodes, but the idea of having like these projects that are meant to react live to interact to inputs instead of like permanently securing them as an NFT. But yeah, so in 2021, a lot had happened. Super rare, known origin. People had been buying generative art for years without knowing it was generative. Or caring. I mean, in those platforms, hashtag generative might have been a tag. And on Twitter, hashtag generative might have been a tag, but people were just overlooking that. They didn't realize that they were buying generative art and that they already loved generative art. And what I think, one of the things I think ArtBlox has done is kind of bring that to the forefront and kind of bring that to the table and kind of say, hey, look, what this artist has created by typing words into a script instead of, you know, with a brush on Photoshop in comparison to digital art. And so I think a lot of things kind of came together at the same time. I think the advent of more PFP projects that are also generative, because nobody is making 10,000 unique images with a paintbrush. Nobody is. And if they are, that could be a really cool project anyways, if somebody had. Well, I guess Damien Hirst piece was 10,000 like handmade unique pieces. So that's cool. Very generative-ish. But yeah, no, nothing really.
Eric, I mean, before we get into the generative side, I have one punk question for you, given how long you've been here. So I always go back and forth a lot on, you know, whether, you know, I want to buy the floor of something or whether I want to buy, or, you know, can on most cases, but, or whether the rarest is kind of the play. And the curveball that I always get is, we're an investor in Fractional, and I love the idea for fractionalized NFTs, but I guess the thing that I always struggle with is, you know, fractionalizing a super rare punk increases the addressable market from, say, 10,000 to infinite. But on the flip side, you don't really have that sense of ownership, right? Like, I don't own one punk, or I don't own a squiggle, or, you know, so you kind of lose that, but you get the financial upside of the rarest version. I don't really know where I'm going with this question, but I guess I would love your thoughts on like the community slash speculative angle of the fractionalized version. And I'd love for you to frame it as like if you'd ever consider fractionalizing some of your own.
Well, first, I will ask you this directly. As owner of a fraction of a punk, does that entitle you to print it and frame it and hang it on your wall as if you own the, I mean, anybody can right click, save and print and frame, but do you feel that owning a fraction of a piece of art entitles you to right click, save as, print and frame if you owned it?
That's a really, really good question.
Because I don't know.
To be dead honest, I'd say unless I owned a good chunk of the fractionalized shares, I'd say probably not.
Right. And so, but at the same time, fractional ownership enables people to kind of have that little connection to the piece, and no matter how small that fraction is, right? So I don't know the answer to that. I feel, you know, I have my own vested interest. For example, I own 10% of an Alien that I purchased as a result of a very last minute, semi-irrational and incredibly reckless
rational purchase, in hindsight. It's all good.
Yeah, a decision that some people in Flamingo Dow made. And I don't control that Alien. I don't have it. I have no way of accessing it unless I convince seven other people to send it somewhere. And actually, I think now it's a lot more than seven, but it was at one point. And if you think about that, I want to be able to print my Alien and put them on my wall, but I don't own them completely. I've always had this dream of having a CryptoPunk museum where, cause I do have like one of every attribute CryptoPunks, and like where I would just hang all the attributes, but then there would be this one at the very end with a big question mark on it. And it'd be the Alien, cause I don't actually own an Alien. And so does 10% allow me to do it? I mean, technically I'd say that Flamingo Dow should maybe give like leasing rights, or not, you know, they don't have to charge for it, but say, okay, at any given moment, any of you 10 holders can hold it for 1/10 of the time and can show it, but then you kind of should just take it down, because that's what would happen with a real piece of art, right? Like if you fractionalized a real piece of art, you couldn't shred it into different pieces. You would actually just kind of rotate it amongst all the fractions. So there's something really interesting there to be discussed. And I think that there's opportunities for platforms to essentially kind of delegate temporary ownership to owners of fractions or shards of a piece, especially higher end pieces, to kind of say, you are currently the owner of this piece. You're currently in control of this piece, and do that in a decentralized way where, you know when your turn's coming up and you know when your turn is over. And then for your second part of your question, because I mean, I believe as a crypto Lego building block nerd that fractionalization is incredible and exciting and amazing. As an artist, I don't know how I feel about it. I feel kind of weird about the idea that, especially in generative art, when we're creating non-fungible tokens and then refungibilizing, if that's even a word, feels kind of, you know, counterintuitive to me. But I'm also speaking as someone that has been around long enough to own full pieces. And like, you look right now, and if you want a Chromy Squiggle, it's what, like $30,000? Like, that's not fair. That's completely absurd. And the fact that somebody might want to feel like they have a piece of that, not even from a financial perspective, but like I genuinely did not buy the Alien as a fraction from a financial investment perspective. I just wanted my little piece of the last thing I didn't have in the Punks, you know, collection. And I think it sucks if you can't have access to some of these things. So I think fractionalization is great. It's just weird as an artist, and you'll speak to a lot of artists that feel the same way. There's a slight discomfort. And then there's other artists that are like, absolutely not. I don't ever want to see myself fractionalized. Not that they can do anything about it, obviously. And then there's artists that are all about it and real excited about it and creating bundles for fractionalization. There's beautiful things happening in fractionalization, for example, where you're seeing people that fractionalize an art box collection send the tokens to the artist as the equivalent of the 5% royalty. And so, you know, if the idea of secondary market royalties is participating in the success of your work and the future success of your work, having that 5% of the tokens is exactly the same as having the 5% royalty for each transaction. So, I mean, that's beautiful. And that kind of stuff will turn an artist into being a believer in fractionalization, right? Like, hey, I'm the artist and I got to have a little bit of this as well and participate in my own success. I think that's great. But only time will tell what fractionalization really does and what it really looks like in the art world, and just how Artblocks just had 2 months of like massive FOMO and speculation induced by markets and induced by, you know, kind of, again, speculation. but that's not necessarily, that's not our target as a platform. That's not our goal as a platform. We need to see what happens with fractionalization, DAOs, governance, not in a time of madness, but in a time of calm and reflectiveness, like the bear markets that everyone kind of dreads, unless you're a developer. And then you're like, oh my God, I can't wait for the next bear market. Like, this is when we're going to build and discover and get to know ourselves and see how people really act when they don't have this potential FOMO of 2Xing to 100Xing over the course of a weekend, which is kind of like this expected result of crypto right now.
That's an incredible answer, Eric. And I guess the thing that I go back and forth with on fractional or just fractionalized NFTs is like the community side of this, right? Like, I'm kind of with you. Like, I love the idea that I could own part of something and be part of a community, like, you know, buy part of an alien. It could be in that community, or buy part of, you know, a perfect spectrum squiggle and be in that community. But to your point, I go back and forth on that. Like, everyone's able to use the likeness, but, you know, at what point, like at what ownership level do you need to feel like you're a part of the community to promote something? I guess that's an individual question for the masses, but are you bullish on DAOs and communities coming together to use the likeness to promote projects, or do you think that may be more of a dream?
I'm super bullish on DAOs. I'm 150,000 times more bullish than I was last year at this time on DAOs. I still think it's early. I still think there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of questions around longevity and what the future is going to look like. But I do think that if Arblox has taught us anything, it's that communities have this way of sprouting around group ownership of something. Obviously, CryptoPunks was the first to do that. But just the fact that Arblox has kind of, for a lot of drops, not everyone, but a lot of drops, you look and they're a little bit more personable, or they come from an artist that kind of has a nerdy background or whatever it might be. But for a lot of art drops, you find like this factory of community sprouting. Like, it's like every drop, especially early on in Artbox curated, right? Like, we had curated drops, and then immediately after the drop or during the drop, there's a channel and everyone's yelling about their pieces and, oh my God, mine is this, and oh my gosh, mine's blue, and I love blue. And you know, some people were buying every curated drop, and so they all participated in that. But then you come back to that channel 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, and you would have a dwindled group of people that have literally not stopped talking about that drop since the drop itself, and curating sets that look good together, and curating like pieces with other sets that look good together. And just you basically have the like devoted supporters of each of those artists. And sometimes they're shared across different art categories or art projects. Sometimes there's people in our Discord that only post on one artist channel ever, and that's their entire engagement with the Artbox community. That factory of communities sprouting up after that is something really new and something really special. It's something that happened with punks. It's happening with like the Bored Apes. My God, that community is insane. And so there's no reason why that wouldn't apply to DAOs and fractionalization as well. The difference, of course, is that everyone having an individual item is kind of what gives everybody in this internet world a sense of individuality. And so, you know, you are going back towards a DAO structure or a, you know, governance structure in the sense that you don't have that one piece of the community that makes you unique. But when you start seeing derivatives of art pieces, like for example, if one day a Hyperpipes squiggle becomes like the entire reason for a DAO to get together by one piece, and like that's like their grail piece, well, maybe there can be a derivative piece made by another artist that takes that squiggle and derives something that is individual to each member, and that's the membership token of the DAO. And now everybody kind of has their individual component again. Well, it's hard to say now. It'll be really much easier, I think, in like 2 or 3 months if we can sustain this level of sanity that I think is starting to come around for our crypto community. This will be a really interesting conversation to see in 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, Eric, the thing that I'm getting out of your like what you're sharing is pretty authentic, and I love it. It's that like, you know, you mentioned earlier, like spending a ton for a squiggle, which you created and we'll talk about, is incredible, is expensive. And you're talking a lot about the craze right now, which you kind of want to die off a little bit so we get back to building. It's got to be hard to like take the view of like, I want to authentically build this, but also I don't love the craze. Like, I guess, how do you like deal with wanting to build for the long term, but I guess maybe pumping the brakes a little on just the crazy hype that we're seeing.
Yeah. I mean, I never want to be directly pumping the brakes, right? Like that feels like it's not me personally, my position to do that. And the last thing I want to do is cause panic. It's more like we know that the brakes are going to be pumped because it's like, I think there's something that we can all agree on, very straightforward. The more expensive the starting price is of a piece, whether it's on Artblocks or on the secondary market, the less X it can possibly ever have. In other words, if something you can buy something for 0.1, it is much more likely to 100X or 1000X than something that you can buy for 1, period. It's just like there is actually a ceiling in the amount of money in the world and the amount of money in the NFT ecosystem. And as you approach higher prices, you are closer to that ceiling. Like that's a fact. There's no, like, you know, I'm not trying to be philosophical here. Like you are closer to the final ceiling. If you can't see that when the entire space, and I'm not talking about just Artblocks, I'm talking CryptoPunks, I'm talking everything, starts hitting this like really close to what I consider to be just a actual ceiling, and you think that it's impossible for that not to be sustained forever, then I don't know. I mean, I think you have some looking back to do. I mean, I encourage everybody to look at the chart of every single crypto platform ever from 2012, probably, whether it's an altcoin, a major platform. I mean, other than the really big ones like Ethereum and Bitcoin that have had local highs and lows and then keep going higher and higher and higher. It would be really difficult to think that Artblocks could somehow be a unicorn and simply just go up forever. There has to be a retrace. There has to be like a point where everyone realizes, hey, this is getting a little hot and we need to kind of take a step back. So we don't intentionally do that. A lot of people think that the Dutch auction was a way for us to intentionally do that. It's not at all. The Dutch auction has many, many purposes. And as you can see in today's drop, when the Dutch auction is not, when a drop is not being fueled by speculation, the price of the piece just settles at the base price of the piece and everybody just goes on with their day and they can buy it if they want. I mean, we want Artblocks in the end to have multiple projects mintable on the platform at any given moment, like we did for so many different months. And that is a signal to me that speculation and FOMO is no longer dominating what we're doing. And if that's the equivalent of pumping the brakes, then that's the equivalent of pumping the brakes. Our intention has not been to hurt, you know, anybody buying at a higher price. I paid double the mint price for Geometry Runners because I really wanted that piece of art. I'm just as guilty as everybody of like probably making irrational spending decisions. So it's not like we're sitting there going, ha ha ha, look at all these guys like blindly. No, like we're doing it too. We're in this space, but there's a key differentiation. We're doing it because we love the art. And if there's speculative potential, great. I encourage everybody to make as much money as they can in this world, but please don't count on that when interacting with not just Artblocks, with any NFT project out there. You just can't. It's just impossible for everybody to win.
No, that's a very clean answer, and I appreciate that. And I'd like to dive into Artblocks a little bit on, you know, just the genesis, the goals. I mean, for those who aren't aware of what Artblocks is, I'll give a brief overview, but you guys are a platform focused on programmable on-demand generative art. It's all stored on Ethereum's blockchain. When people pick a style, it's randomly generated using an algorithm on smart contracts, and you get the resulting piece. And I read that right off your website, so I'm not some type of genius here or anything. But you know, you guys have a really interesting design because there's a lot of obviously fantastic artwork on Artblocks, but you guys have different ways for artists to post. Like you have a curated section, you have a playground section, a factory section, which offer different levels of entry for artists to get involved. I'd love for you to kind of give, I guess, the vision from like the artist perspective on using Artblocks. And if you could dive a bit into the curation aspect, that would be really important because I think people look to Artblocks and they say, hey, if this is on Artblocks curated, has to be legit. And that's kind of like a mental model that people have, which is very powerful.
Yeah, it's powerful. It's also a little scary, but I do think that's why we have professionals on this board of curation to kind of pick these projects. For an artist to deploy something on ArtBlocks, there's two reasons. I mean, there's probably multiple. One, they've been in the generative space for a long time. And before ArtBlocks started showing explosive growth or showing that artists could make a ton of money, artists looked at the method of creating a cap to an otherwise unlimited algorithm, which is what generative art is, right? Before ArtBlocks or other projects like ArtBlocks, you as a generative artist would create a script. And if there's artists that did not follow this procedure, please like ping me and tell me what you're... But like for me, as someone that was always writing algorithmic art and kind of creating with code, you write a script and then you press spacebar to refresh and refresh and refresh. And you just look at the outputs completely randomized. And then you're like, oh, I don't like when brown and red go together. So I'm going to write an extra line of code that says, if background color is red, then foreground color cannot be brown. And then you press the spacebar, and then you haven't seen any of those two that you don't like. And so you keep pressing the spacebar and pressing the spacebar. And then you run into something else where it's like, well, this cloud overlaps the mountain, but it looks like it's on top of it or something. So then you write some more code to really kind of, and I'm oversimplifying it, but to really kind of get the outputs to where you want it to be. And then once you get it to that point, you'll press the spacebar and save each of 100 outputs, look at all of them, and decide this is the one that I want, the one, the five that I'm going to put forward. Putting forward a piece means posting it on Instagram, Twitter, submitting it to a show, submitting it to a contest, giving it to your gallery that represents you to print and frame and hang on a wall or show at an opening. What happened to the script after that was that it was just still there. So there was this ephemeral kind of quality of never-ending art that could be produced from a specific algorithm, which in one way is really beautiful, but in another way is just kind of like, it's just, there's just like this unlimited, it's like a hole. And so I think one of the things that drew artists to ArtBlocks early on, before it was like, you know, huge profit potential, is the idea that they were able to kind of prove, kind of like a screen printer will do an edition of 10 screen prints and then destroy the molds, which they may not videotape themselves destroying the molds, right? But like if you documented the destruction process of a set of screen print, like screens, sorry, not molds. You document the destruction process of a set of screens. Yes, you can always go make the screens again, but you kind of document that those 10 screen prints are the only 10 screen prints that are ever going to exist. In generative art, there wasn't really a good way to documenting that. Like you don't just delete your code off your hard drive. Like that's weird because you spend a lot of time on it and some artists will reuse kind of specific aspects of it. And so what ArtBlocks kind of did was allow artists to kind of commit to code in a finite way. And because they had to commit before they saw what those outputs are, they had to really, really, really manipulate that code and tweak it and like massage it into getting it to a point where every single output was perfectly identical. That I think was and continues to be the compelling reason why ArtBlocks artists, like generative artists, are interested in deploying on ArtBlocks. And as is very expected, soon to be other generative art platforms, because it would be really wild to think that there will not be other beautiful generative art projects out there and generative art platforms, which we welcome into the space. So that's, you know, that's the main reason why I think people were kind of there in the first place. And, you know, your second question about curation. So we early on realized that like we were getting beautiful submissions and then we were getting good submissions and some mediocre ones and some that sometimes we even thought, oh man, this shouldn't even be on ArtBlocks. And we had to make a very early decision to make sure that we were a platform, not a gallery. And that has changed now. But early on, the idea was anybody that makes anything that's algorithmic, especially if you've been doing this for a while and never really had a stage or a theater for it, like we want ArtBlocks to be your stage and your theater. We want you to have this opportunity to put your stuff out there the way that I think generative art lives, you know, like happily. And so, but we wanted to make sure and distinguish the pieces that really stood out. So we created a board of curators that has grown from 10 to about 25 people. And these people are collectors, artists, people from the traditional art world, people that have never opened MetaMask or had an Ethereum wallet, gallerists from the traditional art world, investors in ArtBlocks, investors in NFTs, DAOs, Flamingo and the Lao are both, or Flamingo, sorry, is a curator on ArtBlocks, to kind of help differentiate the pieces that it's not that they're better, but the ones that better take advantage of all of the features that ArtBlox does and creates for artists to be able to really shine in the generative space. So those pieces are the ones that we call curated. And then just to kind of button this up, like then there's two other sections. We have the playground and we have the factory. The playground section is very, very straightforward. It's any artist that was previously curated gets badged as a playground artist. So in our current website, there's a drop down for that. In our new website, it's actually just a badge. And that badge says, hey, this artist previously achieved curation status. And then we have the factory. And the factory is originally was just that. It was this place for just generative art, for people to literally just put their scripts out there, especially projects that would be submitted to the curatorial board that did not get accepted as curated. We still wanted to host the art. It's beautiful art. It might just not be able to handle 1,000 iterations, or it might not have a technical proficiency, or it might, you know, have whatever else just didn't meet that curation board standard. And so the factory has some of my favorite ArtBlox pieces of all time and is a really good example of just like the variety of what you can get in the generative art world, from artists that are brand new to generative art that like created their first script after learning about ArtBlox versus artists that have been generating, you know, exceptional creative code examples for like, you know, years or a decade.
I really love your answer. I also like that you have these three different formats for artists, because you're not like cutting off a good supply of good potential artwork that can come to you. You're opening the gates a bit. So I want to preface my next question with, you have other ways for artists to post, such as the factory or the playground, if they've already been curated before, for the playground specifically. But I guess for the curated side, if we have to pinpoint there, like you've grown the council, the curators to 25 to decide, but like, how do you think through that long term? Like, you know, an outsider would say, these 25 people are deciding what's good. But on the flip side, you know, people like me, like, I kind of like that. You know what I mean? You guys are experts. Like, how do you think through decentralizing that versus having the control? Because at some point, that council gets too big where the coordination just becomes a problem we see with crypto projects today.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. We absolutely want to decentralize ArtBlox. I'm too much of a decentralization nerd not to do that. I'm just not in any rush whatsoever. We are hitting landmines every single day as a platform. It is just absurd to me to some things that require instant decision-making. It is absurd to me to like hand that over to a group of people that may or may not be there because of the speculative value of their decentralized token. And while I think we're absolutely almost there in terms of like the ecosystem and decentralization, I don't think that ArtBlox is anywhere near at a point of letting everything happen in a decentralized way. If you take a step back and you look at the curation board, when I first came up with the idea of the curation board, I was thinking, man, okay, this is going to be a smart contract. We're going to make these rules. If you vote yes, you have to purchase the piece. If you vote no, you can still purchase it, but you're going to have to fight with everybody else at mint time. If you vote yes and you don't buy the piece, you get three chances. And after you do that three times, you're out. Whatever, like, I think there's something beautiful about being able to put these rules into place that would essentially enable transparency in a way that just kind of doesn't happen in the curation world. The problem is, like I said earlier, like a lot of people don't even have wallets. And to be fair, ArtBlox has just kind of grown way faster than expected, and we just haven't gotten to a point where we can do that. And also the idea that a curator would have to spend $75 to $100 every time just to paying gas fees to vote yes or no was just out of the question. So yes, there's L2 technologies that are going to enable us to do this. And we will absolutely, you know, embrace those. And when the time is right, we will decentralize curated. But I think something that's really important that I'm really excited about, and I can't commit to a certain timeline for this, is decentralizing the factory. It would be really nice for the community to decide what they want on the factory. We are, when I said earlier, we're kind of shifting from a platform to a gallery, not on purpose, but we have finally started saying no to some projects that have approached us for the factory. And it feels awful. Like, that's not the intention or the point of ArtBlox. The problem is that our pipeline is too big. There's too many artists. There's too much really, really, really great work that we want to put out there. And eventually something has to give. So it would be really nice, just because I feel like everybody at ArtBlox is just like a really nice person and I feel like I have the best team in the world. It would be really nice for us not to have to be the jerks. but like for the community to vote and say, you know what, I really just don't like this and I don't want to see this on our box. So when there's a governance token on our box, could be a year, it could be 10 years. It is the last thing on my plate right now that I'm concerned about. You can count on the fact that the first thing that that governance token will do will be allow people to either just vote people into the factory, or just more likely based on people's timeframes and timelines and like busyness, reject projects from the factory using a unanimous vote, or not unanimous, but using like a majority vote of the token holders. So if the community feels strongly enough that there's a project coming into the factory that they just don't want to see, you know, they can petition for people to vote against it. And I think that's okay. I think that's fair. And, but we're just not there yet.
No, that's a fair answer. I like that you guys are thinking about, you know, allowing the globe to kind of curate. And I also like that you guys, you know, ultimately don't want to be the arbiters, especially on the factory side. In the short term, it's a big undertaking. And I also agree with you on the token. I mean, if you have a project like you guys that is growing so quickly, you don't really need token incentives right now to fuel that growth.
We don't want the token to be related to that growth, right? If our goal is to transcend crypto, which it is very much our goal, you know, the early adopters are the people that are minting Fidenzas and ringers for $200 and $300, right? So like, if you look at a Kickstarter campaign, like we didn't have to like raise capital or give people equity. People early on realized the value of these pieces, either because they really love them or because they saw the potential future speculative value of art, and they minted the pieces, and like they already have a huge, huge upside to like when we transcend crypto and like the regular, you know, the meat space folks join. But I think it's really weird to think that you'd have like a governance model in place that is controlled by a very, very specific component of the population. Like we have to be pretty real in that the crypto space is male dominated, like it incredibly severely male dominated, and it, as is the traditional art world. And I think that, you know, for art blocks, there's a lot of things where you'll see that we want to just make sure that we don't miss an opportunity to change something or to do something differently. And here's one way that ArtBlox can kind of do something differently is wait till the ecosystem matures a bit. Wait till we've transcended the crypto speculative nature of, you know, NFTs, because that is a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths that don't like NFTs fairly. And then figure out a decentralization model that includes everybody, not just the people that are here right now. And again, for the people that are here right now that would yell and say, well, but you know, we're here supporting now, like, you know, we should get some kind of reward. Your reward is everything that's happened in the last 6 months or 12 months of our blocks and having been around early enough to participate, you know. And I don't feel like I'm granting you that reward. I think the community is granting itself that reward, and I'm very proud of that.
I really like that. Everything you're saying is authentic, long-term planning outside of hype, and respect that. I want to go back for a bit. For those that, there's a lot that happens in crypto that's under the hood. You know, I don't think people, you know, new to the space understand, like, you know, what happens when they submit a transaction on Ethereum or consensus mechanisms, and they don't really care about how L2s work. They just want it to work. But the way generative art is created is like phenomenal. Like it's groundbreaking. Can you kind of just walk through the quick process of like how an art is minted based on the algorithm? And I know you went through kind of the iteration process before for an artist to kind of create that algorithm, but like what actually happens when somebody hits mint on ArtBlox?
Ah, beautiful, beautiful question. So ArtBlox at a smart contract level is actually not rocket science at all. We are storing an algorithm on a blockchain as basically proof of the algorithm, proof of what the instructions are to produce the thing that appears on your screen when you mint. That algorithm is stored one time at the root level of a project and becomes immutable over time. The moment someone presses the mint button, what they're minting is not an image or specifically an output from that algorithm. They're actually minting a set of variables in code. It's a very short string. Well, it's kind of a long string of characters. It's 64 characters, 0 through 9 and A through F, which is a hexadecimal character. And it's a string of characters. And that string of characters controls what the algorithm shows. So to make it incredibly straightforward, simple, if the first character in your string of characters is a one, and the algorithm reads, and it has this, it's waiting for this input for that first character in the string. And the algorithm says, if the first character is a one, background color will be white. If first character is a two, background color will be green. I'm really oversimplifying it, but that's the very, very root of what's going on. Now, you take that and extrapolate it into shapes and colors and gradients and patterns and motion, and that's what you're looking at in an art blocks piece. An artist is taking, instead of just the first character and picking the background color, they're taking 16 characters and creating what's called entropy, or a bunch of randomness out of those characters that controls the outputs of each piece. What makes ArtBlocks special is the determinism of those outputs. In other words, every single time you run the information stored on your NFT token, because your token in the end is when you run the variable stored on your token against the script that's stored on chain, the output should be identical every single time in every single environment. And this is special because, for example, right now, you know, we're seeing 8K televisions. In 25 years, we'll see 24K televisions, or I don't know, maybe 100K televisions. And one of the really important things about ArtBlocks is, since you are generating the finished product onto your screen at the moment that you're viewing the piece, and you're running an algorithm that is listening to variables stored on your token, that algorithm is running at whatever the resolution is that your screen is at that moment. So if I'm looking at it on my phone, it's running at, you know, 800 by 800 pixels. If I'm running it on 100K TV, I don't know how many pixels that'll be. Let's say 25,000 by 25,000 pixels. I have no idea. But and the algorithm will produce the exact same results. So if a line is this thin on a small screen, it's going to be this thick on a big screen, because it's going to scale with the size of the canvas. And that's a really important component of ArtBlocks. If you look at the most expensive animated GIF in the NFT space today, in 20 years, it will either have to be upsampled to fill screens of the future, or it will be shown with a huge frame around it on screens of the future. It's one or the other. And upsampling, I think by then, is going to be magical, and it'll probably be perfect, and it'll probably be even, you know, meet the artist's standards. But the fact that an ArtBlocks piece is running in the way that it's running in your browser or on your TV or on your phone means that that is not one of the features that we're concerned about for the future of generative art on screens and devices where they're meant to be shown.
Jesus, that's fascinating. I did not know that. So, wow. So when you're viewing ArtBlocks code, like if I'm viewing a squiggle on, let's say, this 24K TV of the future, I'm not viewing some static file. I'm viewing, what exactly am I viewing?
It depends. So we do store static images, right? Because a lot of marketplaces are looking for an image to display on a page to show a bunch of mints. So whether it's CryptoSlam or OpenSea, if you're looking at all the thumbnails, there is an image that's necessary. Otherwise, your computer would burn down running 30 iterations of the Chromie squiggle script at any given time, like as you're scrolling through it. It just, computers aren't anywhere near powerful enough to do that, or to do that safely or comfortably or smoothly. So obviously we do render and store an output of the script, and that's something that we've really honed. So like when I say ArtBlocks smart contract is not rocket science, because it's not, the work that our developers have put into creating this backend that 1,000 mints can be rendered in less than 1 minute, like let's say that a drop is selling out instantly, is pretty special. It's pretty unique. And that's something that I think that we're doing a really good job on. So separate that image, which is static, which is going to look grainy in the future if people are looking at that same image. What you're looking at on your screen when you open a Chromie squiggle in what we call live view is you're looking at the live script running in your browser. You are, if the screen is supposed to have a red background, you're looking at the algorithm reading that token ID and saying background color red, because the token says that. And proof of that with the Chromie Squiggle is that if you click on a Chromie Squiggle, which this is something that's really wonderful when people haven't really realized this yet, if you look at a Chromie Squiggle in live view, it just looks like a static image. And then if you click on it, you'll see that it starts going through the color spectrum. It becomes animated. That animation isn't a GIF just like running through the frames. It's actually the algorithm changing the colors of each individual circle in the Chromie Squiggle in a sequence to create this pattern. And to further that, if you think the pattern's moving too slowly, you can press the arrows up and down on your keyboard and speed up the animation or slow down the animation. And if you really like to see a Chromie Squiggle on a medium gray background, you can press the spacebar button 10 times and change the background color of the squiggle that's animating on to get to the background color that you desire. It's the idea of creating the squiggle as a static element and then letting people interact with it versus just kind of when you mint a Chromie Squiggle, it just becomes instantly animated, was intentional. It was there to kind of surprise people and to really drive that point home that when you look at even a static project on Artblocks, so let's say like one of my favorites is Elevated Deconstructions, right? If you look at Elevated Deconstructions on OpenSea, that thing is a very static project. It doesn't move at all. But every time that you load the full token image, not the thumbnail page that shows all of them, but when you open the image and load it, you are looking at your computer running that code and creating that exact same image in that smaller window at the time of viewing the piece. And the squiggle being animated furthers that. It just kind of demonstrates what you can do with code and with algorithmic art. And we're really excited about those components.
No, it's a fascinating answer because it's just so different from, I think, what people think is a static image. And I love the viewer. I'm always hitting spacebar to try and find a squiggle that perfectly matches the black background. Me and one of my partners, Coley B, that's what he's known as. We frequently look for one. I didn't know about the arrow keys speeding up the speed of the animation, though. That's pretty interesting. That's pretty cool. And God, it's a really cool answer. And I guess the other question for you is like, so you're the creator of Chromie Squiggles, and the question for you is like, how do you as an artist decide, you know, hey, this is what I want to run with? Like, there's so many variables for you to create something. Like, it's literally like overload out of all the infinite opportunities for you to create artwork. How did you eventually settle down and say, hell, this is the code I'm going to run with for Squiggles?
I've been following generative art for a long time. I've been creating code-based art, some of it generative, some of them not, for a really long time. And even as long as I've been doing that, like, there is a very much a sense of imposter syndrome when you compare it to like some of these masters like Dimitri and Chettle and Tyler and Alexis. Like, as much as I'm proud of my Chromie Squiggle as an artist, I still feel this imposter syndrome because it is something that, you know, it's my craft. It's my baby. Like, my Chromie Squiggles are my babies. Every single one of them is like special to me, but I have not dedicated my life the same way that these guys have dedicated their lives to generative art. I've been following it maybe longer than they've been creating it, but like, I still have not been creating. And so for me to come in and like create this piece, which I'm very proud of, it's hard sometimes to kind of consider it as like a work of art, or is it? Because originally when I created the Chromie Squiggle, it was a demonstration of what could happen with Artblocks. So my brother created Genesis, the project number one on Artblocks, way before I even created the squiggle, as a demonstration of what Artblocks could do, as a demonstration of what deterministic hashes can do to control the output of a visual algorithm. And, you know, I wanted to demonstrate it even further. And so I started tinkering. First, the first squiggle was actually created on 3JS. And 3JS is just a different library for three-dimensional graphics. And little by little, it was migrated. Then it was migrated to processing. In fact, my brother helped me take my 3JS code and convert it into processing. And then eventually, as I started launching Artblocks, I then took my 3JS code and converted it into P5JS because I felt like that. I actually, and even though P5JS and processing are very similar, my brain kind of melts with processing. I just can't manage that code. Whereas like 3JS and JavaScript in general and P5JS, I understand pretty well. So to answer your question, though, like, when do you know, like, what? Okay, so I wanted to demonstrate. I mean, with the squiggle, it's very straightforward because it was originally a tool, not like this art piece, right? I wanted to demonstrate that you could have almost infinite variability with the source of a hash. So to do that, you start to realize, okay, like every point on a squiggle can be positive or negative, and it can be any of 100 points. Actually, it's decimals, right? So like between 20 and negative 20, like with decimal places, it could be anywhere along those lines. If you have 12 points and each of those can have almost infinite point locations, you already have like an almost infinite place to prove variability of an asset or of an art piece. Then the starting color is really important because, you know, you can show that something starts with a specific color. The spread, which is like how fast it goes from red to green. All of a sudden, I just started kind of adding things specifically just to show the variability of a hash. I've always been driven by gradients. I love rainbows. I love, you know, bright colors. And so obviously that's reflected in the work. I've just always kind of gone out of my way to kind of demonstrate that type of like life or happiness. And so it was driven by that drove a lot of the Chromie Squiggle development. And then finally, because I love the idea of the zombies and the aliens and the apes, I wanted to add Slinky and Hyperbold and all that, because I felt like that's something that as a participant in the CryptoPunks Discord of 3 years was one of the things that kind of drew the excitement of the community, is by adding these things that we call features that are just not as commonly available as others. So the end result was this thing that was originally meant to demonstrate individuality is meant to be as stupid simple as possible. Like, it doesn't get simpler than like a little squiggly line. But then I realized, because I created the squiggle in 2018, I then spent 2 years looking for squiggles in other applications and realized that the squiggle, as stupid simple as the squiggly line is, was not something found commonly in culture. Like, we just don't see a lot of it. I mean, and I started thinking, like, anytime I'd see something kind of close, because there are some like squiggly lines that have gradients in them, I'd be like, if you held a like, would you confuse that for a squiggle? And if the answer was no enough times, to where I was like, okay, yeah, I created this for a utilitarian reason, but now I'm realizing that it actually has like an identity to it that feels unique, and it feels like it stands out, and it feels that if you saw a squiggle, especially for us NFT nerds right now, if you see a squiggly line, you might first think, is it a squiggle or not? And at that point, I kind of went from thinking, you know, I lost a little bit of my imposter syndrome and just decided, hey, like, this is art. Not as demonstration of the power of what like NFTs or blockchains or hashes can do, but as a demonstration of how something so simple and clean can actually stand out and be visible and be recognizable to the general public. I kind of rambled a lot there. Sorry, but yeah, that's the
no. You didn't ramble at all. The rambling is awesome because I love you unpacking your work, which really set the stage in a really cool way. And I guess my other question for you on squiggles and just generative art in general is, I guess there's a big difference between rarity and aesthetics in a way. Like, sometimes they're not linked. Like, the example I'll give you is like, you know, I think the normal squiggles look amazing. Like, trust me, I love full spectrum. I love perfect spectrum. Like, they're incredible squiggles. And I mean, the other kind of point here is like End Project, like the spinoff of Loot with just straight numbers. Like, you could mint generative art off those numbers, but you know, like, I minted a gen art piece off my end, which is not rare, and I got a very rare output for N-War, I think it's called. Like, so it doesn't always line up one-to-one on rarity and aesthetics. I'd love to get your take on that. And I'm not asking you to, like, give price predictions on what's more valuable, but I'd love your take on, I guess, how you think the community views rarity versus the visuals.
I think this is multifaceted. I think different people are driven by different things, 100%. Right? And so I still owe the community a floor squiggle competition that I had promised a long time ago, where people would submit floor squiggles, because I still just love squiggles and like floor squiggles. I love the basic squiggle. And I wanted to do that to emphasize how much I actually just love the regular squiggle. So if you're driven 100% by rarities, there's nothing wrong with that. there's just people that like to own things that are more special and more unique. Now, the chunkers, like the bold squiggles, I love the way they look too. So there's something special there too, right? Like there's people that collect just the bolds because they just love the way that they look more than a regular squiggle, and that's okay. And they happen to be more valuable. I think there's just a lot of different collection attitudes. There's people that collected hundreds of floor punks, and then there's people that collected only the high value ones, like the kind of the rare ones. There's people that only made purchasing decisions for punks based on really weird combinations of punk characteristics. And there's people that literally just bought the cheapest punk on the market. It depends a lot on your speculative nature. If you're driven literally by the speculative component of NFTs, there's a chance that you might just be buying a lot of the floors, and that's okay. If you really just want to get into NFTs and you see a floor squiggle that you think looks really good, then you might buy that and become more personally attached to that and maybe even get it tattooed, as has happened already, which is just mind-boggling to me, but very flattering.
Eric, whenever somebody gets a tattoo for a project, that is such a bullish sign. I can't tell you how many times that's played out.
It's so wild, man. It's like, it's just like one of those tears in this whole experience.
Rabid community.
Like I will never forget that moment when I saw that tweet. I was on another call and I just looked at my phone. I was like, that has to be fake. Oh my God, that's really real. So yeah, I think features are like a really fun bonus of this whole space, but I don't think they should be the driver. There are some incredible Fidenza and Ringer sales that are happening based on floor models. People just really like that specific one and it doesn't have rarity. Then you have other things like, for example, archetypes. I love floor archetypes. I really like the cubes. I think that it was a really smart move to make that specific component more rare. I think that in another world where it wasn't generative, or it can still be generative, but like without art blocks, let's say Chettle was creating archetypes and others for, let's just say super rare. Like as an artist, he might've just chosen to mint 20 archetypes, what we consider floor archetypes, and put them on super rare. But if he felt that the cube was more special or more like dear to him, he would have only minted three. The difference is that he would have minted those three at a significantly higher price, thereby stating, this is what I like better, and this is more dear and more special to me. Whereas, even though that's kind of inferred when an artist creates a programmatic rarity in a piece, it's not this statement of, this is a more expensive piece, and therefore it's more rare. Everybody has the same chance of minting that piece during the drop, and then after the fact, those pieces become more rare. The most expensive single NFT that I ever bought in my entire life was an Archetype Cube, by far, like significantly more than any others. And I remember sitting there with my wife and she's like, you know, and then she just reached over and like hit my mouse and like clicked submit. And I was just like, oh my God. Like, and this is way before the hype, right? So this is like an Archetype Cube at that point was like $27,000, like an insane amount of money for us to spend on one thing. But that also kind of validated something there, where the only other thing I'd ever bought that was over $1,000 was a car. And it's not like we were just like to a point financially in our lives where we could just blow money, but it felt like the right decision. And it kind of helped solidify a little bit of this thought that one day unique and like highly visible art box pieces would garner really high prices based on the fact that they are popular, they're more visible, more popular, and therefore more desirable by a group of people that thrives on an internet based on their avatar being something that represents them and their individuality and their originality. And so, yeah, that was a moment where I was like, what? That's nuts. And then, okay, all right. And now obviously, like, you know, if you look at it from a financial decision, like it's probably a good financial decision. But I could care less. Like my Archetype Cube is one of my most prized possessions, you know? And it just, you know, so I don't know if that answers your questions, but like it shouldn't
be the driver.
It can definitely appeal to some people more than others though.
No, it does. And it's always worth the memory of your wife freaking out. I've had my girlfriend freak out and I've bought some NFTs too, so I kind of get it. yeah, it's always exciting. Like, hey, I spent X on Y and they'll be like, what? Like, but it's exciting. And I guess one of my last line of questions for you is on, I go all day with you, but I want to respect your time. But the community aspect is interesting here. And I don't mean to boil this down to like a bad question, but I'll play a little bit of a devil's advocate here. What do you think will be the claw or the hook that gets people to stick around for Squiggles and Archetypes and Fidenzas like 2 years from now? Like Suzu had a really good tweet a couple weeks ago or days ago, I forgot, it was too many, where he said, you know, most people want the most important cultural aspects of a culture, right? For Ethereum, that will be probably Art Block's artwork, right? But the other thing is, there is a lot of hype right now. It's not like you can go use your Squiggle and play Axie, right? It's a very different use case. But with that, like, how do you think people will stick around for pure generative art if it's not usable, but it's obviously gorgeous? Like, where do you see that playing out?
Man, the
it's a tough question. I don't mean to lob it out.
Yeah, I mean the future is very, very uncertain. I'll preface this by saying that, and to all of my punk family, please, if I'm wrong here, just yell at me. But I swear that there were full weeks that not a single message was sent to the punks Discord during the course of 2019 and 2020.
Jesus.
And if it wasn't a full week, it was a couple of days at the very least. And I know that because the moment that I built my CryptoPunks collection, and I was already there every single day from like basically right after I claimed. But then I had this like zealous desire to get an alien. And I literally thought that the day that I didn't check Discord was going to be the day that somebody posted an alien for like, you know, a cheap price or an affordable price, and I was going to miss it. So I was there every day, every single day. And in no way does that correlate with the value of CryptoPunks today. In fact, it is counterintuitive. Like you said, that was not too long ago. It is counterintuitive to think that something created in 2017 and in 2019, nobody but maybe a handful of us was nerding out about this, where we could go full weeks without even like saying anything because there wasn't really that much to talk about, right? Like there wasn't that much going on in the NFT space, and you know, our punks weren't going anywhere and people weren't necessarily buying them. The people that were there, that are there today still, and that were there in 2017, not everybody has the, you know, the privilege of having been there to claim, and there's nothing against that. Like, I do think that there's this weird like bias towards people that were there at the claiming. I think it's a really kind of cool thing that we get to nerd out about that, but whatever. Anybody that joined the CryptoPunk family, even at the crazy prices of last week, to me is like a visionary in terms of what they see in the future of this stuff. And yeah, I fully expected, and I'm seeing the hype calm down a little bit on Art Blocks. And I think that's okay. I think, you know, first of all, our goal with the platform is to have 30 projects open for minting at any given moment, maybe 100 one day. That can't happen with the hype. But even in times of hype, if you have 30 projects open for minting and all of them sell out at the same time, we're once again reaching that fundamental cap of what can actually exist in terms of financial liquidity. Like there's only so much money. There's only so much ETH in the world. So I think that we're going to go through a lot of cycles. I think that we're going to see, especially now, I mean, in 2018, I was pitching to like Matt Hall, hey, I want to make some stuff. I'm too embarrassed to even share what I was wanting to make with CryptoPunks. And he's like, yeah, it's kind of early for us to give you, you know, the right to do that. And I actually very much respected. I was actually bitter at the time, right? I was like, what? Like, you know, I have these things. No one's really talking about them that much. And like, I have these ideas and I'm a businessman.
Discord's
have,
dead. I'm building. Yeah.
Yeah. Things have changed. I have somebody reaching out to me on Discord that literally made a Squiggle dress and is literally wearing it regularly, including going to be wearing it at NFT.nyc. And as these elements become recognizable in society beyond just our NFT nerd space, the conversation will continue. And if it doesn't, and if the NFT space collapses. Like, man, people are yelling about like ArtBlocks volume being down. People were buying a CryptoPunk for 150 ETH one day and 99 ETH the next. Like, it's okay. This is part of what we're experiencing. And the people that are buying at higher dollars are experiencing much higher risk, but hopefully they're in a position financially to take on that higher risk. And the people that are feeling shut out from the industry now, either they wait around until some other new project comes around that becomes more affordable, or they wait around for like the economy to kind of sizzle out a little bit and people to start making more rational choices and decisions and purchasing. And once again, I am very guilty of making very irrational purchasing decisions. So I'm not putting myself superior to anybody else in this space. Literally buying Geometry Runners, three of them off the secondary market for 10 ETH each, 10 to 12 ETH each. Like, that is a very irrational decision that I made, but I really just wanted one of those pieces. I don't think that's sustainable. I bought those very well understanding that it was very likely that they could potentially continue to go up, but it was also very likely that they could go back down. And we just need to all understand that if we are in it for the art, there's a meme in our Discord all the time. People say, I came for the flip and I stayed for the art. Like, it has been said so many times, and it literally is like the encapsulation of what we're doing right here. We are thinking, maybe to a fault, that we are creating a new generation of art appreciation. We are creating a new generation of superstar artists. Sorry, we are not creating them. We are amplifying them. We are giving them a place. We are giving them a home. And if there's lulls, let there be lulls. We will build better. We will build more. Artists will have to start doing better and creating better art. If artists start putting stuff on ArtBlocks and it doesn't sell, other artists are going to take that as a signal of like, ooh, I better step it up. And trust me, no matter how slow ArtBlocks is right now, even if ArtBlocks went to not selling a single piece in the next week, there are artworks coming down the pipeline that you and I would look at and be like, I'm going to buy that regardless of whether ArtBlocks is selling or regardless of whether there's FOMO in ArtBlocks right now, because it's genuinely mind-blowing art. And that's all we care about on this platform, is that we constantly provide artists with an opportunity to share their incredible talent with a new community, a new audience. I think we're doing that. And I think we're doing that pretty well. And I think we're doing that well regardless of the hype. In fact, man, I think I might have mentioned this in Discord a couple of times during the hype times. Like, we are not having fun. The ArtBlocks team, during these crazy times, we are not having fun. It is not fun at all. In fact, it's awful.
Chaos on the inside, but it looks amazing on the outside.
Yeah, it's awful being called greedy and cash grabby because we're trying to control gas wars and trying to control speculation and whatever. Like, it is just awful. Like, let us get back to where we were. And in the meantime, we are not changing our MO. We are moving forward with just providing, like, hopefully the best platform for generative art that exists and that will ever exist in this world. And that's our goal, and we're sticking to it. And all these other things can just, you know, come and go, and we're okay with it.
Goddamn. Eric, the passion, man. I wish you were raising. This would be a totally different, this wouldn't be a podcast. This would be a call. But a couple of rapid fire questions for you. Multi-chain NFTs. Do you have do you have an attachment solely to Ethereum, or do you see ArtBlocks potentially expanding, or how do you view that?
For now, we are producing, I think, some of the best generative art in the world, and we're putting it on some of the most decentralized ecosystem. Like, in my opinion, you know, one of the most, because I think Bitcoin is pretty damn decentralized at this point. So I'd say one of the most decentralized ecosystems in the world. And I think there's a really nice correlation there in terms of value proposition and quality. Unfortunately, we started this platform with the idea of equality and like equitable minting, and people could mint a Chromie Squiggle for $40. And even that felt like it was a lot of money, right? Like, if you're just kind of speculating, or not speculating, but like dabbling in like a new subject, a new area. And I think that the opportunity for that to exist on Ethereum may be gone forever, at least at those levels. It doesn't mean that ArtBlocks pieces will not get down to 0.1 and 0.05. It just means that there's clearly an interest by people to participate in this this performative or experiential aspect of minting, where you create something at the moment of purchase. And I do think that there's room for it to exist on other platforms. So we are exploring not just L2s, but we are exploring other L1s. And we don't know what that looks like yet. We don't know if, you know, very likely I can say this, that an Artblocks piece, no matter where it is being minted, whether it's on another, on an L2 or maybe even on another L1, the script and the provenance of that script will live on layer one Ethereum for it to be stamped as an Artblocks piece. Like I don't know what the future holds, but that's what it feels like right now, where we would utilize these other technologies for minting. But yeah, maybe one day there's like Artblocks Lite on Flow. And, you know, I really am a big supporter of Flow. Full disclosure, I also am validating on Flow, right? But it's not because like I just wanted something else to do. Like last year in June, Flow blew my mind in terms of the team and what they were building. Like I always equate it to like Ethereum is like Microsoft. It's just like gets shit done. It's like the machine. And Flow to me is like Apple. Like the team, the branding, the graphics, the messaging, it just feels like the one that's going to make everybody use MP3s, and in this case, NFTs, right? So I have this like special place in my heart for Flow. Not everybody on my team agrees, so and I value my team more than anything else. So like ultimately, we may never end up on Flow. But as an example, I like to use the example a lot. Like if I have a crypto voxels parcel, and I want to create a little forest of trees, I can take a Vox model tree and I can just copy and paste it and copy and paste it and copy and paste it. But my crypto voxels parcel might be worth $15,000, $20,000 or something kind of like that. I mean, I don't know what the floor is at, but let's say that the floor is at $10,000. I just bought a $10,000 thing. Like you don't take and buy a $10,000 thing and then put, I mean, you can put zero effort into it and that's totally fine. But if I want to create a little forest outside my crypto voxels house, and I could go to Flow or another L1 or an L2, and I could mint 100 generative trees that are all unique and that I own them, and I prove that I own them, and they cost me $1 each. I, maybe weird nerd consumer here, would rather spend $100 to have 100 generative and provably unique trees for my crypto voxels parcel than just to take and copy paste the same tree or copy and paste the same 5 trees that I just kind of scattered across my plot, which is really the only thing that you can do now. So, yes, I want Artblocks to provide that. I want Artblocks to exist to serve generative content to people. And as a result, we will have to explore these other blockchains and these other layers of the Ethereum block.
Incredible answer. And my other question for you is just on being early versus being late, right? Like you mentioned earlier, squiggles are expensive, right? Like I'm always torn because I'm never sure. And this comes down to an allocation sizing question. It's my last question for you too before we hop off. But I feel like you either have to be really early or you missed it on NFTs. Or if you're a large fund, obviously you could enter in at a later stage because you have to size up. But what's your take on the irrationality for buyers? Like, do you think people should just optimize for being at the mint stage to get in early? Or do you think there's still value to be had in the later stages?
I think people in 2019 thought they were late. I know people in 2020 thought they were late. I think it's irrational. What I would say is that the later you are, and the quote unquote later you are, because you're not yet late, the more time you should dive in and learn and explore and listen and watch before you start making purchasing decisions. There were times in 2017, 18, 19, where, well, actually in those times, like there wasn't a lot of traction on a lot of stuff. So maybe you wouldn't even have made purchasing decisions. But I think the only difference that should be applied to being early and late is the amount of research that you should do to make sure that you get the right thing. And, you know, I use Kickstarter as an example. I used to love Kickstarter. Man, I mean, when Kickstarter launched, it was this beautiful platform to share your ideas with the world in a way that didn't really exist before. And if you were there early, middle, or late, it didn't really matter. 80% of the projects I bought, I never got the product. It just never came. Excuses after excuses or whatever. It does not matter if you're early or late. It matters if you research. If you look at the team that created the Form Labs team, that printer, and you read about them, you could tell that that printer was going to be one of the biggest printing companies. I mean, I could. Biggest printing companies in the world a couple years later. All the other stuff that I bought on Kickstarter literally was just disappointment after disappointment. I even created my own Kickstarter, and I actually produced it and shipped out 1,000 of these things. And it's a pain in the butt. But I think being early or late is like kind of a misnomer. You just never know. In 2019, you were still really early to what's happening today, but you might have been discouraged and walked away. In 2012, you might have gotten excited for selling Bitcoin for $7 a piece. Like, what do you call that? I mean, that's early. Like, that's a huge problem to people these days, like that they sold so early. So I think really it's very relative, and I think people should just take a step back and realize, hey, like, this is going to be fun. If this isn't fun, don't do it. Learn from people. Don't be like guided by the hype. When people start saying things like the floor is being swept on XYZ, that person probably bought a lot of that piece just before they said that to cause you to be like, oh shit, I better go in and buy it. Like, just be careful. Research, think about what pieces are going to mean to you and to other people, and then make your decisions. And I don't think being early or late has any implication on that whatsoever.
Eric, I love your entire answer. Full disclosure, I use the Squiggle and the Squiggle DAO. I also love that beyond the time of this conversation. But I think ArtBlocks is really moving the generative art space forward. I love your multi-tier curation mechanism. I love the passion that you and your team have for real long-term building out of the hype cycle, and just the level of authenticity and detail you put into building your project, your platform, and the artists that come on there. So I really, really appreciate your time. I'm a huge fan, and thank you so much again for coming on.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me. Thanks for listening to me ramble so much.
Ramble's the best part, man.
They were good questions. They were really good questions. Thank you so much.
Before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsors for making this episode possible. With a proven track record of delivering products safely, the Kava platform is DeFi's most trusted, scalable, and secure institutional-grade cross-chain engine. In addition to the protocols Kava and Hard, the Kava platform is launching Swap Protocol, a cross-chain AMM liquidity hub bridging DeFi, blockchains, and financial services to swap the world's largest assets and maximize yields across your entire portfolio. Try for yourself or learn more today by visiting kava.io. Celo is an open platform for mobile-first DeFi with a vision of bringing decentralized financial tools and services to anyone with a mobile phone. Eco-friendly, Ethereum-compatible, and governed by Celo holders, Celo's proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and automatic daily carbon offsets make Celo the world's first carbon-negative blockchain, offsetting over 2,200 tons of carbon to date. To learn more about how to lend, earn, and stake with Celo's growing family of platform-native stablecoins, visit Celo.org today. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.